This is Place Matters, a podcast at the intersection of race, place, and poverty, where we explore the belief that the path towards ending inequity and promoting prosperity is through the work of holistic neighborhood development. Welcome to Season 6, Voices from the Field, where we speak with historians, researchers, authors, and thought leaders whose work is shaping the field of place-based development. I'm Sean Duncan, the Director of Training and Consulting for FCS and the host for Place Matters. In 2017, the book The Color of Law hit the shelves and quickly went viral, exposing how racial segregation in our communities is not a matter of personal choice, but a matter of government-sponsored, enforced, and funded mechanisms. The book made it clear how cities across the nation, not just in the Jim Crow South, baked segregation and inequality into the very design and function of their neighborhoods. This design was not only established in the pre-civil rights era past, but has been legally reinforced in the decades since. As important as this book is, it left thousands of us asking, what now? If this is the nature of the problem we are facing, how in the world do we move forward toward a more just and equitable future? Well, thankfully, the answer to those pleas is now here. Richard and Leah Rothstein have teamed up to release a follow-up book entitled Just Action: How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. Joining me today to talk about this welcomed response to our urgent questions is one of the co-authors, Leah Rothstein. Leah has spent decades working on public policy, affordable housing, and community organizing. Listen in as we talk about the real and tangible solutions to the shameful segregation that has come to define American life. Leah, thank you for, thank you for the work that you're doing. Thank you for making time, for being on, for putting this amazing resource out into the world. Just overall, thank you. It's a privilege and an honor to get to talk to you today. So thanks for being on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, no worries. Well, before we get into the stuff in the book, I'm curious, like, what drew you to want to contribute to this field, to be a part of this work? Most people don't just accidentally stumble in this level of passion for something that's this big and socially important. So what's kind of been your journey to want to be a part of this movement?
Yeah, well, how far back do you want to go?
You start it. You tell me. I'm always interested in how people get into this.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I grew up in a household with, maybe it's not obvious. It'll become obvious in our conversation, yeah. I think. I grew up in a household where, you know, talking about social issues and contributing to making the world better was the norm. Both of my parents were activists and organizers. And so I just sort of understood that that's the way adults interacted with the world, that they, if you see something that isn't quite right, then you have an obligation to sort of step in and do something about it. I actually even thought as a kid, because both of my parents were activists in the anti-Vietnam War movement, that and the civil rights movement, I sort of thought that, like, I would go to college and then there would be a massive social movement for me to join. But that's just what happened, you know. And I learned that, no, you have to make it. I did start organizing in college around to defend affirmative action in California. So I've always been interested in issues of equality and sort of justice and racial justice. I worked as a community organizer and then a labor organizer after college, working on kind of community development issues, police accountability, workplace safety. And in that work, you know, was really inspired by organizing and building up leadership in communities, but also sort of a little frustrated by the obstacles that policy would put in our way. And, you know, and so I wanted more facility with the policy discussion. So I went back to school and got a master's in public policy, and I focused there on community development policy and affordable housing. And I worked in that field for a while, and then worked for a bit in criminal justice reform policy. And in that time, my dad wrote the book The Color of Law, which I think we'll talk about, and it had a huge impact. And And I sort of saw that happen, you know, and then had a chance to be a part of the follow-up to that book to continue, hopefully, its impact on the country.
Yeah. Well, it definitely comes out. I think I read enough to know when there's like high-quality research that's really crucial to the field that needs to be out there, needs to be read, versus like high-quality research from a person who's like bled for this, you know, like that they've lived it, they've breathed it, they've been around it at a like deeply ground level. And so like throughout the pages of Just Actions, like this is not a dispassioned treatise on the academic principles of changing our segregated societies. Like this is really coming from people for whom this is a lifeblood kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So just to affirm that, I'm sure you know it, but man, it's just really rich to read that kind of blend through the process. So for those that I think most of our folks are going to be familiar with Color of Law and the work that's there, but since Just Action does the big work of all, like when all of us finish Color of Law, we're like, yes, what do we do now? Well, if you're one of those people, this is getting to the answers to that question of what now. But if anybody's listening that is maybe heard of it, hasn't gotten into Color of Law, could you give us a kind of a snapshot overview of what the case of Color of Law was building?
Yeah, the Color of Law, my dad wrote it in 2017. And the premise of that book, or the whole point of that book, is to debunk this myth that we've come to accept as a country, that we are racially segregated, that our neighborhoods are racially segregated by what's called de facto segregation. The idea that the segregation happened by accident, or, you know, by just because of personal preference, that people like to live around people who look like them, or it was a result of private actors like, you know, bigoted landlords or realtors who refused to rent or sell homes to African Americans to live in white neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the cause of government policy or government action. That's the de facto segregation idea.
Right.
So the Color of Law took on that idea and called the de facto segregation idea a myth. And it completely debunked it with example after example of government policies at all level over decades, local, state, and federal policy that required explicitly, it wasn't a hidden, effort at the time. It was explicit and intentional segregation of our communities.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's, I remember myself reading it, and like a couple of things happened. So I've grown up and lived in the South my entire life. And so I don't know if it was good news or bad news, but I was like, yo, this ain't a Southern thing. You know, like there's so much in Color. I was like, this San Francisco, Dallas, Baltimore, Detroit, like go anywhere, it's everywhere. And the other piece was like, even having come in with the awareness of our racialized practices and policies, to see how comprehensive and widespread it is. It's not just a couple of high level, it was during Jim Crow. And it's like, yeah, Jim Crow is a part of this, but man, the system is so much more robust and structured than that. So yeah, if you're one of those people that either still thinks we're segregated by choice, or you're aware that it's racialized in some way, get into Color of Law if you really want to see the systems that established kind of where we are. And as you jump into Just Action as the follow up to that, one of the things I'm struck by is that you're saying that we don't just need we do need policy interventions, but that's not enough. We need, like, to your point about going to college and there being this like massive civil rights movement, but you're saying if we're going to desegregate the reality that we're in, we need something that's a level of a civil rights movement towards it. Why would you raise it to that level versus just saying, hey, here's two or three policy fixes that we need to put in place? You're saying we need a new movement to counter where we are. Why would you say it's that big of a thing that we're addressing?
Well, because those policy fixes, which we do need policy interventions, but they don't happen without political pressure, without the pressure and organizing of local groups in our own communities, pressuring their governments to make those policy changes. You know, it's been many decades since the Fair Housing Act passed in 1968, and little has changed in the segregation of our communities. So if we just wait for policymakers to come around and make different choices, we'll be waiting another 70 years. You know, we need to start taking on these issues in our own community. And what we argue in Just Action is we need this sort of reactivated civil rights movement to take on residential segregation. And even though we do recognize we need national, you know, federal policy change eventually, we also understand we don't have that kind of political will on the federal level, but we can build that political will locally in our own communities. And there's so much that is, you know, once the federal government had a large part to play in creating segregation, but once enacted, it's to a large extent enforced and maintained by local policies and programs. So there's so much that we can actually impact on a local level to begin to undo segregation. But it takes local organizing, it takes activated residents and people working together on these issues. And that's what will build the movement we need to make these changes.
Yeah, I love that you say if the level of structure and intentionality that created segregation, we're going to need at least an equal amount of force to undo it and to build something more just, where I think we see the harms of the past and maybe we have an awareness of how complicated, complex, comprehensive that system was, but usually our answers to it are so much less structured and organized. And like, if the issue is this big, our response has got to be equally as big, which is like what I love about Just Actions is helping us to conceive of, there's such a broad range of interrelated changes and interventions that we can make that we got to jump into that stuff together. So this is fascinating. So one of the things that you ask is like, even those efforts that are trying to address poverty or inequality, like, we're not even from the beginning building with the question, are we aiming to desegregate things? And so like, say more about just that not even being on the framework, even of social good-minded developers or policymakers out there.
Yeah, well, you know, when we talk about segregation, say we're talking about the segregation in the South that, you know, was fought against in the civil rights movement, segregation of lunch counters and buses. You know, once that was outlawed, those lunch counters and buses could be integrated the next day because the law changed.
Yeah.
But with housing policy, if you change the law and you pass the Fair Housing Act, as we did in 1968, you're just looking to the future and changing, you know, outlawing future discrimination. But there were decades and decades and decades of government policy that created the communities we live in that then therefore create the opportunities we have as individuals and as families and, you know, the wealth we have access to.
Yep.
So there's a lot of sort of built up cumulative impacts and consequences of past segregation. And we can't attempt to really undo it unless we're intentional about what we're trying to address and redress. And so a housing policy without an intentionality around making some progress to desegregate an area, it will likely not have a desegregative effect because we are already living in a society of huge racial disparities. So if you enact a racially neutral policy, it will further those disparities.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to have racially explicit policies and remedies to remedy the racially explicit policies and crimes that our government committed. We can't expect to make advances in racial justice by being race neutral.
I was thinking, there's a conversation recently I was having with a colleague, and it kind of feels like the Fair Housing Act was a way of saying, hey, this, you have cancer, but we're not really going to do anything to repair that or fix that or heal that. We're just going to name that it's bad to have it and it's dangerous to have it. So like, cause I remember years ago, first kind of becoming aware of a lot of this, kind of going, wait a second, you mean Fair Housing Act's been around for 50 years and our housing gap between white and black is still the same? How are we 50 years in? And then you begin to look, it's like, oh, because we just said it's wrong to continue, but we didn't do anything to repair. So you mentioned like there's the affirmatively further fair housing stuff that's out there. Say a word about that. Like, what is that? Is that helping? Or if it's not going far enough, what's missing from some of the efforts that are there?
Yeah, the affirmatively furthering fair housing, it's a mouthful, AFFH.
Just comes right like poetry, just rolls right out, right?
As policy usually is, sounds so poetic.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a provision in the Fair Housing Act that says that government not only can't discriminate in the sale and rental of housing, but has an obligation to affirmatively further the purposes of the act. So it can't just sort of be passive participants in challenging segregation. Now, the Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968. It wasn't until the Obama administration where that provision was really articulated what it means for jurisdictions to affirmatively further the purposes of the act. So the Obama administration enacted a rule that any jurisdiction that receives federal community development money, which is every city and county, has to go through a process in order to be eligible for those funds of a community-wide comprehensive planning process to investigate what the obstacles are to fair housing and desegregation, what are the policies and programs and sort of institutions that maintain segregation in that region, and what can be done to undo those obstacles and to further fair housing and desegregation efforts. And these policy, these planning processes, you know, had to involve all sorts of government agencies, community organizations, so cross-agency, cross-discipline, school districts, transportation agencies, local governments, public housing authorities. And they also were required to have, quote unquote, robust community participation. So they had to get the public involved in this planning process. We wrote about the New Orleans Fair Housing Center, the Fair Housing Center in New Orleans, that conducted a very comprehensive affirmatively furthering fair housing process and created a very comprehensive plan that outlined like 50 goals and objectives and a responsible agency for each goal. And they're now going through it. And the region has to comply with this plan. You know, it's now a government approved document. So it's a great provision, and it could go a long way towards getting sort of all the right people, including the community, at the table to start to talk about how we can address desegregating our communities. Now, not surprisingly, Trump rescinded the AFFH rule that Obama enacted. Biden has promised to re-implement it, and there's a proposed rule out there. It hasn't been enacted yet. But a lot of jurisdictions are going through the process anyway because they anticipate that it will be coming. And, you know, California has passed its own AFFH rule. So there's ways to make sure that this is still going on and that our communities are engaged in these planning processes.
I think, you know, so one of the things that FCS works on is homeownership. We recognize that there's a cascading number of benefits from increasing access to home ownership. And certainly in Just Action, you advocate for, yes, we've got to expand Black home ownership if we want to move towards more just and equitable communities. But you also say that like increasing home ownership rates is important, but not enough. What do you mean by that? Is like there's, that's not going to be the, you know, the solve to what we're facing.
Well, yeah, we say that home ownership is an answer, but it's not the answer to addressing segregation and reducing the racial wealth gap. Now, it's an important piece of the answer, certainly. We can't kind of address and diminish that racial wealth gap if we don't increase opportunities for home ownership amongst African-American households. But alone, it won't do it, and there's several reasons why. So home ownership, we think of as a vehicle sort of for very like assured and quick wealth creation. You own a home, it's gonna appreciate in value, you're gonna build wealth, you'll then, you know, have more to pass on to your kids. And that's how home ownership has worked for many white families, partly because they bought into home ownership when it was affordable in the mid-20th century and subsidized by the federal government. And at the time, African Americans were prohibited from buying those homes. So whites then bought these homes, they accumulated in value, you know, they built wealth that way. African Americans prohibited from doing that. Now, with equal access to home ownership now because of the Fair Housing Act, African Americans don't have the intergenerational wealth to buy into those homes because their parents and grandparents were shut out of home ownership when it was affordable. So homes are more expensive. They have less to put down, they have higher mortgages. So you can build less wealth that way. There's also a lot of obstacles to building wealth through home ownership that African Americans uniquely face compared to whites. So one is the property tax assessment system. And in communities and metropolitan areas all around the country, you know, the property tax assessments are done by local county assessors. And in communities all across the country, African-American homeowners are overpaying in property taxes in relation to white homeowners. It's sort of a complicated explanation, which I can get into if you'd like. But basically, because of how reassessments are done on the county level, homes in white neighborhoods are assessed at lower than their market values, So white homeowners are paying less than their fair share of property taxes because you're supposed to be paying property taxes as a percentage of the market value of your home.
Right.
But if your assessed value is below your market value, you're underpaying in property taxes. Mm-hmm. Whereas in African-American neighborhoods, the homes are assessed at closer or sometimes even higher than their lower than their market value. No, I'm sorry, higher than their market value.
Right, yeah.
So African-American homeowners are paying higher than their fair share of property taxes. So if you're paying more in property taxes, you are less able to build wealth through that home ownership. Yeah. That's one example, and there's many others that I can give of sort of these programs, institutions, policies that are racially neutral. You know, they don't have a racially discriminatory intent, but they have a racially discriminatory impact. And if we want home ownership to be the wealth creation tool it can be for African-American families, we have to address all of these other obstacles as well.
Yeah. And I think that's an important part of this, is that there's both at play. There's intentionally racialized practices, whether it's policy from the government or the practice of the market or just interpersonal racist biases, right? Like, yes, there's all of that. And if we only think about solutions through the lens of that which is overtly or intentionally there, even if we cut down all the things that were intentionally racialized, the battle still wouldn't be won, right? Because there are, to your point, there's so many things that are race neutral, but the impact is disproportionate towards Black and brown communities. And so, like, we're actually just talking about this the other day, that we've been working with Georgia Tech in our own neighborhood to do some measuring around corporate investment in single family housing in our specific neighborhood and how much equity has been lost from the foreclosure crisis up until today. So, you know, 10-ish year period gap. How many millions have been, even this small neighborhood that we've been working in for 25 years, like how much equity has been lost from corporate investors? And like, you know, somebody was saying, like, I certainly believe in the racialized impact, but you know, this stuff, you know, was not geared on purpose to harm Black people. And at some level, I don't know if that's important. I mean, maybe it kind of is, but at some level, it's like, if the impact is disproportionately harming Black and brown communities, then we have to deal with that as a racialized policy, on purpose or not. It is doing that. And then how do we, to your point in y'all's book, how do we defy that? Like, how do we go against that system to start building that which is going to be fair and equitable and just? And you mentioned like all credit scores as well, like something that at this stage we all feel like is just a normal, natural part of the market and the way it works. But you guys talk about how even credit score is another one of those like built-in barriers that are going to prevent Black and brown families from building wealth through homeownership. So how is that stacked against Black and brown communities?
Yeah, we think of the credit scoring system, like you said, as just the way things are. You know, it's an objective rating. You put in information about your financial history into a credit scoring algorithm, and it gives you a score that tells the bank if you're a good candidate for a mortgage or not. To some extent, that makes sense. If you've defaulted on loans in the past, maybe you're not a good candidate for a mortgage and you'll have a lower credit score. But it's not as objective as we think because of what the kind of financial history that gets fed into creating a credit score is only a certain type of financial history. And it's a type of financial history that whites are far more likely to have than African Americans. So it's the type of financial history that comes from traditional financial institutions like banks and credit cards and mortgages. And, you know, African-American communities, segregated African-American neighborhoods of all income levels have fewer bank branches than similar economic status white neighborhoods. We call this, you know, financial redlining. It still happens today. There's just less access to traditional financial institutions if you're living in a segregated African-American neighborhood, even a middle class neighborhood. So if you have less access to traditional banking, you likely have less access to credit cards, and you might rely more on, say, a payday lender, because that's what's in your community. And even if you pay back your payday lender loan with their exorbitant interest rates, you pay it back on time and in full, that financial history,
which is harder to do,
which is harder to do than paying a credit card.
Yeah.
That type of financial history isn't factored into a credit score because it's not a traditional financial institution. Similarly, if you've had a mortgage in the past, you know, that is sort of in the financial record and that gets fed easily into a credit scoring system. But if you've been a renter your whole life, which African-Americans applying for a mortgage are more likely to be first-time homebuyers than whites, Mm-hmm. So there, say you've been a renter your whole life, never missed a rent payment, never missed a utility bill payment. You have a perfect financial history that way. That information also isn't automatically included in a credit score.
Wow.
So through no fault of their own, African Americans, not because they have worse financial history, they just have a type of financial history that isn't counted in a credit score.
Yeah.
So far more African Americans than whites have no credit score at all. And of those that do, far fewer African Americans than whites have a credit score high enough to qualify for a mortgage. So this is another example. It's a racially neutral practice, but it has this racially disparate impact and keeps African Americans from homeownership. And to my previous point about limiting the wealth building potential of homeownership, even those Black home buyers who have credit scores high enough to qualify for a mortgage have lower credit scores than their white counterparts. And so they likely have higher interest rates on those mortgage. With a higher interest rate, you could save less money, you build up less wealth. So it's sort of this cumulative problem.
So as a nonprofit, we're 45 years old. We didn't start out to get into the housing world. We just started out recognizing there are neighborhoods in Atlanta that are like concentrated inequity and poverty. And like, we should do something, but we can't look at our city and not be involved. And so at some levels, it was just kind of like the best version of innocent ignorance. Like, we just got to jump in and be helpful in some way. But eventually you can't engage neighborhoods like that without going like, oh, if we don't deal with housing, like, this is human rights level work that has to be done, right? And one of the things we did for a while was kind of like a Habitat's old model of like, we would hold a mortgage for 20 years, 0% interest. So you could have a family who could be 15 years in. I mean, they're 5 years away from paying off their house. Like, how many traditional bank-owned white families could say, we're only 5 years away from owning this house? And if they wanted to get a small few thousand-dollar loan to buy a used car, they can't. And it's like, wait a second, these people have almost paid off an entire house faithfully for 15 years. But again, it's because they're not paying interest to a bank. It didn't count, right? And so we had to go back and go, okay, so what do we do in our model to like help them get into the economic mainstream, like forcing them to pay interest, right? It's just, it seems so insane, right? That it's like, wait a second, we've got to make them take on interest to be better off financially. But at some level, that's kind of the game we've had to figure out to play. So that's where we move towards being a CDFI, so we can do all that kind of stuff. But it is fascinating, the number of barriers that get built in where we just feel like, oh, these are the normal, natural ways of the market, when it's like, no, nothing that is done was not decided by someone, right? And we got to figure out like, who made those decisions and who's harmed by those decisions, and can we make different ones to create more equity?
Yeah, and to that point, we can make different decisions. And even though, you know, with the credit scoring system example, it's a nationwide system. There's these three credit scoring agencies. It's all sort of opaque how it works. But we have banks in our neighborhoods, you know, that we apply for loans from, and we can organize and advocate that those banks, the branches in our neighborhood, the banks and credit unions, that they start to factor rental payment history into their credit scoring. And several have. We write about them in Just Action, and it's possible to get local bank branches to do something different, and that has a real impact.
Hey, guys. If you're feeling challenged by these conversations in our Voices from the Field series and are wondering how to address these realities in your own neighborhood, please reach out to us. We would love to bring FCS's experience to your neighborhood. Place-based work is complex and multifaceted, so don't go at it alone. Whether it's some one-on-one coaching or walking with us through our two-year multi-sector cohort called City Shapers, we're here for you, so reach out to us today at fcsministries.org.
You mentioned like the part of the work moving forward is to invest more deeply into the segregated Black neighborhoods, which that's where FCS is, and we have been, you know, since the late 1970s. And so our work is very like place-based development kind of thinking. And in that kind of section of the book, you talk to different audiences at some level. Like, there's, if you're a developer who's going to be investing in a historically Black neighborhood that's been segregated, or if you're just what might be called a gentrifier, where you're a middle income person who's moving into a neighborhood like this, like, you kind of have some thoughts about, hey, if you're whether as a developer, as a resident, or just an advocate for change, like if you're going to engage and invest in Black neighborhoods, there's a way to think about doing that so that's going to be responsible and healthy. So what would you speak to? Just some advice that if you're going to invest in historically Black neighborhoods, what are ways to do that that's going to be responsible and healthy for the future of that neighborhood?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we talk about these strategies as we want to increase investments and resources in historically, you know, segregated African-American neighborhoods where the concentration mm-hmm. of poverty is a result of government policy that created mm-hmm. its segregation. So to remedy that mm-hmm. government policy and provide redress, we want to make these areas places of higher investment, you know, mm-hmm. a healthier, higher opportunity places to live with more access to mm-hmm. open space and clean air and grocery stores and well-resourced public schools, you know,
yeah.
you know, all of this. And when you do that often in a lower income neighborhood, when investments start to come in, people with higher incomes, developers with deep pockets come in, they see an opportunity, they want to, you know, move into the area and they price out the longtime residents. So mm-hmm. we give a lot of examples of strategies, both individually and policy strategies, mm-hmm. that can help prevent some of the displacement that will occur when investments in these neighborhoods increase and gentrification happens. So we mm-hmm. give an example, the Conscientious Gentrifier pamphlet mm-hmm. was written by an individual who, you know, was a gentrifier in his community mm-hmm. in New York. And he wrote a pamphlet for his neighbors on how to be a conscientious gentrifier, which involved mm-hmm. a lot of ways to involve yourself in the community, interact yeah. with your neighbors, be an active member of the community. Don't just sort of come in as an occupying, you know,
yeah,
person
yeah.
where you don't have any connection with the institutions and the grocery stores and the mom and pop shops that have existed for a long time, and figure out how you mm-hmm. can support them, send your kids to the local public schools, sort of be mm-hmm. a resource for that community rather than a draw on it. And in terms of yep. Policy and what developers can do, I think it's having an intentional eye towards how to prevent displacement as development occurs. Mm-hmm. So supporting policies like inclusionary zoning, which requires yeah. that when yeah. new development happens, a certain percentage of the units have to be affordable to lower and moderate income households. Supporting land trusts that can create permanently affordable homeownership opportunities mm-hmm. in areas with rising housing costs. Supporting protections for renters, you know, rent regulation protections mm-hmm. or just cause eviction protections. Or starting a program, often this is done as a partnership between a local government and a like legal aid society or a local nonprofit that provides free legal representation to tenants mm-hmm. facing evictions. Because often mm-hmm. during a gentrifying period in a neighborhood, often the lower income residents are at higher risk of eviction as landlords see an opportunity to get them out and get higher paying tenants mm-hmm. in. So yep. without legal representation, tenants often have little recourse to fight an eviction. And most tenants mm-hmm. don't have legal representation in an eviction proceeding. But these right to counsel programs provide free attorneys to low-income tenants. And it can really help them prevent an eviction entirely, keep mm-hmm. one off their record, help them access funds that might be available to help them stay in their housing. Really helps to stabilize the neighborhood and keep people living there who otherwise would be displaced. So there's a lot that can be done on all sort of levels, yeah. personal and policy wise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And say more about exclusionary zoning. I think again, you can't get through color of law and just action and leave with the thought, yeah, we're all just kind of choosing to live where we want. And it's all just personal choice that's ended up this way, that there are actually active things on the books that legally protect and promote keeping people out, right? I mean, of course, we've all been horrified by the black and white pictures of the civil rights era of like whites only in this neighborhood or blacks keep out. Like we see that like super overt, like exclusionary, harmful statements. And we, you know, it just hurts our heart gut level to see that kind of action. It's like, well, it may not be a large racist sign on the edge of a neighborhood, but we've actually got some things that are, those walls are just as thick and hard to overcome, even though they might be as visible to us. So mm-hmm. say a bit more about exclusionary zoning and how that has the impact of kind of segregating and kind of hoarding opportunity into kind of white majority communities.
Well, zoning, as your listeners likely know, zoning is a local power that local planning commissions and city councils have to determine what kind of building use can be used where in a city. Mm-hmm. So it can say, you know, this is a residential area, this is an industrial area, this is a commercial area. And then in residential areas, how dense our housing can be. Is it one house per lot, two, or do we allow larger apartment buildings? So it used to be in this country, like you said, that we had actual zoning codes that were zoned by race. And cities had, Atlanta was one of them, had a zoning code that said this is a white neighborhood, written into the code, into the plan, the zoning code, white zoned for whites only, and this area zoned for blacks only. And that, at some point in the early 20th century, became illegal to racially zone neighborhoods. But so many cities still wanted to maintain those racial boundaries. So they took a more overt approach to zoning and zoned those white areas to be single family only zoning, which means only one house per lot, often requiring large lots, large setbacks. Now, what does that do? It makes sure that in those areas, there's a cap on how much housing can be built. And this is true for a lot of white neighborhoods in cities and suburbs. Most suburbs are zoned for single family only homes. Many subdivisions, 75% of the residentially zoned land across the country is zoned only for single family homes. So in a community that's zoned only for single family homes, as demand increases, the housing supply can't increase because you can only have one house per lot. So the housing prices just go up. So for all the reasons we've talked about, we have wealth disparities between blacks and whites. We have income disparities. So as housing prices rise and zoning ensures that those housing prices maintain, you know, stay at a high level, it prices anybody but the most affluent, which is white families, out of those neighborhoods. So this single family only zoning took the place of racialized zoning to do the same thing, to ensure that these neighborhoods stayed all white and kept lower income people of color out of them.
And it's fascinating to see the Atlanta zoning map that had racially overt language and clearly explicitly racial language. And then when they said this isn't constitutional, the map didn't change, just the letters did. It's like, it's literally like you just erased something on your page and wrote something else in. You did not change anything else. And like, no, this is, and again, like, and part of the deal is like, this isn't just 100 years ago. This isn't even just 60 years ago in the civil rights era. This is 2024. This is right now. These are practices, again, on purpose or not, that are excluding black and brown families from certain areas, including certain excluding certain income groups from certain areas. And like, we've got to find a way to build these more inclusive, equitable communities.
I think we have, we think in this country that it's a natural way for communities to look, to have this one house, you know, very low density, kind of sprawling big homes. It's not really a natural way for cities to look. It's not how cities in Europe look. It came from that time when we were trying to make up, when planners were trying to make up, you know, for not being able to zone by race. They zoned for single family only. Like you said, they just sort of erased it and used different words. But those zoning codes, you know, they're still in place. So they have this ongoing effect of maintaining that segregation. And, you know, when we talk about things like climate change or, you know, there's so many reasons why we should have more like closer living, you know, more people living in a smaller area, closer to transportation, closer to their jobs. And to do that, we need to build more housing in our communities and housing of variety of sizes and types to allow for a variety of people to live in them.
Yeah. It's interesting. So sometimes we'll, cause we often are with audiences who are concerned with the state of our neighborhoods and our cities or whatever. And like, just to get a little, as far as like a teaching device, we'll start with, hey, the city of Atlanta, it's working perfectly. And then just let it sit for a couple seconds. You're like, no, it's not. Like, well, what we mean by that is it's doing exactly what it was designed to do. It works perfectly as designed to work. Right. And, but I think again, there's so, whether it's credit scores or interstates or single family lots, there's so many things that we just feel like this is just the normal, natural, like, blind forces of just existence that have us here, when it's like, no, like, look at Interstate 20 that goes right across Atlanta. And why does it dip and dive and turn the way that it does? Like, why are lots, why can't you build more than one sized house on a lot? Like, they're the, one of our team members one time said, hey, neighborhoods are like tapestries and every thread inside of it's a decision. Like, somebody made a decision somewhere for it to be this way. And a number of those threads were overtly racist, right? Mm-hmm. Some of them like didn't use racist language, but intended racist harm. And some of those decisions didn't even factor race in at all, right? Mm-hmm. But still, the tapestry we're looking at is one that has disproportionately concentrated disadvantage in Black and brown neighborhoods and has hoarded opportunities in white neighborhoods. And being able to say, we've got to do the work to change this. And you mentioned like finger pointing. I think this line about finger pointing is the first line of defense. Like whether you're coming from like government side or private market side or individual person side, political side, whatever, like we immediately want to start saying, well, if the government had to done this or if the market had to, like we're kind of shifting where the blame ought to land. And you're saying like, that'll never be helpful. Why is that? Why isn't kind of identifying where the blame sits? Why is that not a helpful strategy to move us forward?
I think understanding our obligation to do something about it is essential. If we are mm-hmm. just finger pointing and saying, oh, it wasn't me. I wasn't around when those policies yep. were passed. So I have no obligation to do anything about it. We're never going to get out of this. You know, there's a metaphor, I think it was Isabel Wilkerson described this very question. It's like moving into a house with a faulty foundation. You move into that house, you're not going to be like, I didn't build the foundation. I'm not going to do anything about it. No, you get to that house and you're like, I want to live here. I want this to be a safe house. I have to fix it, even though I had nothing to do with causing the cracks that existed when I got here. But we all have to deal with them if we want the, you know, the society and country we all deserve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody showed me it's probably a New York Times or New Yorker cartoon of some kind at some point, but two guys in a boat, like one side of the boat's got the hole in it, so it's sinking first, and it's the guy on the other side of the boat's like, not on my side of the boat, I don't care. And that's a thing where, and like Heather McGee and some of us, I think, mm-hmm. probably does some of the most like clear, powerful description of this to say, how do we get out of this zero sum idea that like if we invest in Black or brown neighborhoods or if we change these policies, like because the idea, like even in the single family zoning debate, like the immediate assumption is if we do this and it benefits them, I lose, we suffer, my kids suffer, my wealth diminishes, my opportunities, like our community gets worse. We have all these ideas of like it's this zero sum trading of benefits versus like what she articulates is a solidarity dividend of like, how could we change our way of thinking to say, actually, if we do this to become more inclusive communities, we'll actually all benefit. This isn't just a sad bleeding heart thing for the poorest of the poor. We want to help them. Like, actually, you can be really selfish and advocate for this too. Like your school's going to be better. Your neighborhood's going to be better. Like this inclusionary approach is that will make our cities healthier places to be, both literally because they're more dense and we're less dependent on cars. We become healthier, but also just like socially healthier spaces. And I think like that kind of, it's on all of us like to get into like, this is the cracked foundation. We're all living in it. We can't like fixing it benefits all of us, not just a couple of groups. And I think that's, to me, again, the compelling piece of what you guys are speaking into through this stuff. So you talk about like, if we get to a place where we've done the work, we've had the movement, we've begun to like substantively desegregate our cities. And so we've got neighborhoods that are mixed race, mixed income. We've really broken down that. The deal is like, even if we get there, it ain't going to just stay there because we got there. So even if we're able to do that work, and there's good organizations in Atlanta who are actually making progress to see that happen in certain neighborhoods. But even if we, quote, get there, it ain't going to naturally just live in that space. So what's kind of your advice, what insights on like, how do we perpetuate it, help it to remain and sustain over time?
Yeah, I think all of this is about intentionality and understanding kind of the long game. You know, we're talking about community organizing, we're talking about policy change, we're talking about changing the makeup of our neighborhoods and the landscape in which we live. These are long term, you know, they're not going to be quick fixes. There's not any silver bullet to fixing all of this all at once. So it's smaller incremental change and then ensuring that we maintain those changes that we do achieve. So we end the book with, towards the end of the book, we give examples of three communities that in like the 50s and 60s took on these intentional organizing campaigns to create integrated neighborhoods. They were all started as white communities, like outer inner ring suburban communities right outside of cities. And they started to diversify, or they saw nearby cities start to see black residents move in. And then the community would flip from all white to all black because of, you know, realtors would mm-hmm. incite racial white flight and, you know,
yep.
fear of racial change and falling property values. And these three communities, they decided they didn't want to let that happen. They wanted to instead welcome new black residents and keep the white families who already lived mm-hmm. there from fleeing to create an ongoing sustained mm-hmm. integration. And they all succeeded. Mm-hmm. They had somewhat different, you know, different tactics, but they all based it all on organizing and building community and building a shared mm-hmm. value towards inclusion and integration. Now, they all started mm-hmm. these efforts in the 50s and 60s, and they continue to have challenges. They have to keep working on it right now. Mm-hmm. In a lot of these areas, the issue is housing affordability. Now housing is just yeah. too expensive for anyone to come in. Mm-hmm. So they have to keep, keep working on it to mm-hmm. ensure that these other sort of factors and pressures don't then just resegregate the area mm-hmm. until we're kind yeah. of out of this, this context that we live in where it's just, it keeps us apart and keeps us from living yeah. in the same communities. We have to be intentional about it and continue to work and talk to our neighbors and address all of the factors that pull us apart.
Yeah. So Ryan Gravel is the guy that is kind of the brainchild behind the Atlanta Beltline. And in his book, he mentioned kind of when we think about the scope, the sheer magnitude of the problems that we're facing, he's like, it's not that we can't find solutions. It's just that our expectations are so low. Right? And mm-hmm. I think like that's a part of what is happening is like our expectations are it is as it is because it just is. Right. And there's not really much else we can change. But I think what I've love so much about this and what you guys are doing is like you're changing our expectation. Just in the status quo didn't have to be. We made it that way. And if we made it that way, we can unmake it and we can remake it. And I'm as much as I can advocate to get people digging into this, because I think whether you're not in a community development organization, you're just an individual person who cares, there's salient advice here to grab and get a hold of for impact that you can make, whether you're an advocate or an organizer or a developer. Like, we can all get in on this. And so I want to end where I started. Just again, thank you so much for pouring your life into this mm-hmm. and your research and your work. This is so incredibly important, and I'm just grateful to support your message getting out there in the world.
Thank you so much. This has been nice.
If you have appreciated this conversation, I would encourage you to pick up Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law, wherever books are sold. Place Matters is produced by Focused Community Strategies, whose mission it is to partner with under-resourced neighborhoods to provide innovative and holistic development that produces flourishing communities and God's shalom. Place Matters is hosted by FCS's training and consulting team. If you would like to inquire about our training and consulting services, please reach out to us via our website or find us on LinkedIn and social media. This information can be found in the show notes. If you would like to watch these episodes, the videos can be found on our YouTube channel. And if you like this episode, please share it on social media. Your support means a lot to us. The show was edited by Tim Rhodes with music by Eric North. Special thanks to David Park, Becca Klein, and Rose Silva at FCS for their work in organizing and recording these sessions. We would like to say thanks to our partner, Lilly Endowment, Inc., whose Thriving Congregations grant has made this podcast possible.